Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the inaugural panel for the inaugural Killer Nashville Conference. Thank you very much for coming. I am Reed Farrell Coleman, the Executive Vice President of Mystery Writers of America. We're one of the sponsors of this event. The chapter president in this area is this guy over here, this tall guy, Clay Stafford. He's actually the chapter president of the Southeast chapter of the Mystery Writers of America, and he and his colleagues put this event together. What I'm going to do is I'm going to let my fellow panelists introduce themselves. Let me start with the gentleman on my right.
Hello, I am Darren Butler. I'm a writing specialist for elementary and middle school and high school students in Alabama, and I travel throughout helping children prepare for our state writing assessment. I also write a series of children's books called Abby Girl Spy, and besides from Abby, I work on lots of other things in different kinds of genres. Today I'll be reading from a new young adult novel I'm working on called A Whistle in the Night, trying to work into a young adult area of my writing as well.
My name is Rick Helms. I'm a retired forensic psychologist. I now teach college in Charlotte, North Carolina. And I also am a writer. I write the Pat Gallagher series based in New Orleans and the Emin Gold series based in San Francisco. The two Emin Gold books are on the poster over here. And the book on the right here is Cordite Wine, is nominated for the PWA Seamus Award this year.
Well, you know what my official title is, but now the more important title is that I'm an author. My most recently released book, The James Deans, the book you see here, is nominated for 6 awards this year. It's nominated for the Edgar, the Seamus, the Barry, the McCavity, the Gumshoe, and one other, and I never remember. And if I don't win any, Susan Lucci is going to give me an award. And I've used that line several times about Susan Lucci, and everyone reminds me that she looks much better in heels than I do. So the topic today for the panel is using dialogue to set mood. And I don't believe in that, but, you know, they make me do this stuff. So we're each going to read a section of our books where we feel dialogue really helps set the mood and the tone. Darren's a writing teacher, and he will tell you that tone of writing is a very crucial aspect of writing, which often is misunderstood. Tone sets mood, and dialogue is a shortcut to setting the tone of a book. And we will give you other tidbits of writing secrets along the way, but I'm going to start with Darren.
Yeah, I totally agree. When I'm talking to my students, I'm very fortunate. I work with some of the most amazing kids in the world. And when we talk about dialogue, because my background is theater, I write a lot of scripts for plays as well as screenplays and things like that. And so dialogue is everything. How an actor picks up that script and looks at the dialogue is how they interpret it to present the stage when I'm not there. I'm not there as the director to say it like this. So how I write the dialogue, I write tone into the dialogue, which sets the mood for the scene, and it gives the director insight. So that's given a great help for me as a writer to pass that along to my students and also put that into my writing as well. The selection I'm going to read today is the very beginning of the book, A Whistle in the Night, and my little character, she's about to be 13 years old, and she's the main character of the story, and she lives in a trailer park in Kentucky, and it's set in 1955, and a gentleman has just peddled his way up to her trailer to deliver a telegram, which she does not want to accept. Finally, he opened his mouth again. "Do you know Mary Shaw?" I raised my eyebrows, cranked out a mischievous grin, and said, "I do." The man looked relieved. "You do? Well, at least for the past 13 years, come August the 15th, she's my mama." "Very good." He pulled out a clipboard and a pen. "Please sign here." "Uh-uh," I replied, shaking my head. "Excuse me? I ain't signing for no telegram. Telegrams are bad things. Somebody's probably in jail or dead or worse." The man took a little step backwards. Maybe he thought I was unstable or something. But I wasn't. I just had this habit of speaking my mind, and sometimes I get really loud when my tongue goes to wagging. "Look, honey, I ain't your honey or your sweetie or anything else, Buster, so just take your little yellow envelope and get the hell back out of my bicycle and start peddling." So to me, it sets CJ's mood. It sets her personality. It sets who she will be in the book, the strength behind her character, this young lady, as she fights her way through this mystery. At the end of this chapter, she finds out that she will become the star witness in a murder trial some months later.
Rick, don't you love following stuff like that? Okay. Can you top this by three authors? Here's Rick Helms.
Like Darren, I started out writing plays in college, and also my first professional writing job was writing commercial copy for a radio station in Charlotte, North Carolina. And we had to really get the entire idea into a very brief period of time. We had to start with a mood right away so we could get the message out there, which is basically, you buy this garbage. So dialogue was a very important component of that. So between the playwriting and the commercial writing, I really became highly involved with dialogue, and I've admired writers who've used dialogue very effectively over the years. I just have a very short piece here to begin with. It's actually from an unpublished work that we're working on right now, but it's one of the Eamon Gold series. Now, Eamon Gold is a San Francisco private eye, and there's a character who's in the two books so far named Heidi Fleur, who I've been asked to flesh out a little more, to give her a little more depth. So I decided to go ahead and open this scene with a trip in an art gallery with Gold and Heidi Fleur. I had taken Heidi Fleur to dinner at the Cliff House, and afterward we had taken in a new Marc Chagall traveling show at the Museum of Modern Art. We were parked in front of a blue picture called Creation. It looked to me like finger painting. The emotion is striking, but the real impact comes from its impulsivity, Heidi said. This is spontaneous, like Zen calligraphy. You can see the speed in the work. That comes from deliberating over it for some time until it's concretized in his mind. The act is over in an instant, but the preparation might take months. Isn't that more or less the opposite of impulsivity and spontaneity? I asked. Not in the art world. The act of creation is the instantaneous genius that follows meditation. Uh-huh, I said. Why does that strike me as the same kind of self-important blather that labels a wine impetuous? Philistine, she said, and we moved on. Guy came by the office today, I said. The one with the milky skin. Do you miss anything? Not much. What did he want? He's looking for someone, a guy who helped him knock over an armored car 20 years ago. Does he want to kill this guy? Why do you ask? Because if the guy is missing, that means he has all the money. You don't miss much. I watch television. I know things. I take it you didn't take the case. I think she was listening to me with just one ear as she ran her eyes over Chagall's blue donkey the way a cop frisks a teenage shoplifter. I didn't, I said. Good, she said, and we moved on. The idea here was to begin to establish her as a character that was not just secondary to Eamon, but is actually a major support for him, but also establish her as a character who beyond, she's usually described as being a big, healthy, Northern European blonde, kind of like an Anna Nicole Smith with brains. But we never really established that in the books, the depth of her understanding of her own field, which is art. She's an art dealer. And so I wanted to go ahead and begin to establish more of her. So to make her a more important part of the Eamon Gold books, and so we decided to start with this scene.
Okay, I'm not going to give you any background. I'm going to see if I was effective at doing what I was supposed to do. So I'm not going to give you any background to what I'm going to read, but I'm going to ask you some questions after I'm done reading to see if I was effective at it or not. Do you know Stephen Brightman? My host asked, picking up his Manhattan off the green felt covered car table. Should I? Come, take a stroll with me, Mr. Prager. We stepped through the pro shop toward the practice putting green and along the driving range. Several of the members nodded to Geary. A few took a moment to congratulate him. They regarded me with suspicion, some scowling as if I were one rung up the evolutionary ladder from Silverfish. Do you follow politics, Mo? May I call you Mo? No and yes. I'm an ex-cop, Mr. Geary. Cops don't have much use for politicians, though politicians got lots of uses for ex-cops. None of them any good as far as I can tell, and yeah, you can call me Mo. Though I sometimes find them as distasteful as you do, a man in my position inevitably makes the acquaintance of several politicians. No doubt. He pointed out to the first hole tee box. Do you play? Some. Brooklyn isn't exactly a hotbed of great golfing. You know why they call it golf? Because all the other four-letter words are taken? Exactly. Okay, now I'm going to ask you some questions. Where does this take place? And where, and I, right, and where are, I mentioned the word members, so it's a country club. Right. So there are little hints you can sprinkle in and out of your dialogue. If I just read exclusively the dialogue from this book, you would know the story of the book. The rest of it is just like Hamburger Helper. It fills it in. But if you went through the book and just read the dialogue, I think you would know the whole story of the book. And let me ask my fellow panelists, if we took everything else out of your books, would the reader have a good sense of what the plot was?
Oh, most definitely. I totally agree. Coming from the script background, I really start thinking about a book like a script. I go through and do it chapter by chapter, and I literally go through and I write all the dialogue first. It's kind of funny you said that, the way you do that. I write all the dialogue first, and then I picture it like a movie in my head. I read it out loud to myself. Only my dog looks at me strangely as I do that, and doing all the different voices. And I have that habit, being an actor, being a director, you know, I read it with all the inflection. So then I go back to work on taglines. The word said drives my students a little nuts, even their favorite authors like J.K. Rowling. But I said, you know, said can be a very powerful tool if that's just how they said it. However, if you're trying to invoke some kind of emotion, what picture do you want to create for that reader? When they sit there and read your dialogue, there's no illustration there. It's all words. There's no movie flashing up. There's no TV screen. What's going to engage that picture in their mind? You can do it with one word. It may be one word in a tagline. They muttered, they stuttered, whatever, you know, that you create that picture for them. If the word said is how they said it, then use the word said. You know, it's not like it's a taboo word. But I do. I go through all the dialogue first and then go back and flesh in the rest. And very carefully try not to slow the pace down. You know, let's face it, we're in an action-packed society. I mean, people like to sit down and be entertained. They want to read. I think mysteries are very entertaining. I love mystery stories. So one thing that I get bogged down as a reader is when the author goes off and spends three pages describing one object, okay, and you've lost me. Now, I may love it from the literary standpoint, but I've lost the picture in my head because I read the same way I write. I see it like a movie, and I try to keep that pace going.
I really admire writers like Robert B. Parker, who you really could read the entire book without anything other than the dialogue and follow what's going on. And I think that with my books, you could probably do pretty much the same thing. I'm an I said guy. I started off, when I first started writing, seriously, 20, 25 years ago, saying things like trying to find all these wonderful ways of commenting on what somebody said. He commented, he argued, he debated, he
chided,
he
admonished.
Yes, he ejaculated. Over the years, I've kind of just settled into I said, he said, she said, and maybe once in a long while I'll throw in something else for emphasis, but I'll never say how they said it. I think it was at the Sleuth Fest in Florida this past March where Robert Craze was giving some rules for writing, and he said one of them he said was the adverb is not your friend. That you really don't want to describe how people said things. If you can't tell by what they said how they said it, then you haven't written the dialogue correctly. So I think that if you take a look at the dialogue in my book, so you probably can follow the entire story pretty much through the dialogue and the way that people interact with one another.
I'm going to say that I never... Now, here's something else that dialogue plays into. I never do outlines. So when I write a book, the dialogue actually occurs to me as I'm writing the book. So I don't write dialogue first. I don't come from a play background. I studied poetry in college. I published about 20 poems before I got my first book published. So I don't come at it from that dialogue exclusively moves the story. But even though we come from different points of view as to dialogue, I think you still could take the rest of the book out, and it's funny how dialogue works that way. No, actually, I'm gonna do something that I usually do when I moderate, which is you folks paid money to be here, and on most panels, the audience is told You're not allowed to ask any questions until the last 10 minutes. And I find that incredibly unfair. Plus, it makes all of us work harder to entertain you because we have to do it for almost an hour. I find it much fairer for the people who actually paid to be here and do have questions that occur during the time we're speaking. And then, you know, 5 minutes from the end, it doesn't seem relevant anymore. I'm going to open it up to questions from you guys. Raise your hand. I'll call on you. Clay maybe will come over and bring the mic over because this is all being taped. So now, if any of you guys have questions while we're going on, just raise your hand. And does anybody have any questions? Please, I'll give a copy of my book to somebody who asks a question. The question is that when you have two characters doing dialogue, that it's not really necessary to say he said, she said. And I'll answer for my part is that a lot of times I don't. Some of those he said, she said, I put in there for you so you knew who. Because when you're reading in one voice and not doing a dramatic reading of it, it's sometimes difficult to tell when one person stops and when another person starts. And I also think that this is I'll let these guys answer for themselves, but when I'm writing, there are times when I need to put a he said just to break the mood. Okay, slow down. It's like a rest in music. Okay, that he said, she said, reorients the reader. Okay, now I've got the order right again. Take a breath and let's go. Because no one reads at the speed the dialogue is in a book. I mean, no one's, you know, it's not that snappy. So you're resting. You're giving it a rest. And I'm also from the no adverb school. When you start writing, you do tend to do things like, you know, he said incredulously. And L-Y words, I go back and take them out of the book when I'm done.
I'm very much the same way. What I do is I have an example here. I have a two-person conversation where it says that there's only a couple of he says in this entire conversation. It starts out establishing the first character, who is the grandfather of Emmengold's client. He says, "You know," he said, as he poured the juice in the glasses, "not many people would have spoken to Jack Delroy the way you did last night. Not many people are me. What would you have done if he'd become forceful? I'd have applied greater force. You don't get far in my business letting yourself get pushed around, Mr. Corona. Did you feel that I was pushing you around? Just a tad. I'm sorry. I'm an old man. I don't like waiting for things. For me, there isn't a lot of waiting left. I figure you do all right." He nodded and took a swig of the juice. So did I. It was fresh squeezed from oranges picked just that morning. You can tell these things. "I'm dying," he said. Now, this is the first he said since the very beginning of the conversation. "I'm dying," he said as he put the glass down. There wasn't much I could say to that. "Right now?" I asked. So by trying to modify the voice a little bit and establishing who they are by referring to other acts and other conversations they've had, you don't really need the he said, she said. You know who's speaking. But like Reed said, you really do have to take a break somewhere along the line and reestablish. I was reading one of Robert B. Parker's books down at the beach a couple of months ago, and I reached a point in there where there was a long string with no attribution whatsoever, and suddenly I realized I had totally switched the two characters. And I said, this isn't going to work for me. I've got to go back and start over again so I can figure out who's saying what. And when I did that time, suddenly it made better sense.
Well, I feel like I'm being redundant here and follow the same thing they're saying, but I totally agree with what they're talking about. You have to sometimes put it in just for yourself as the author to make sure you keep it straight. But what I do is I'm going through a chapter, and I'll go through and write a chapter and do a rough draft and edit, and then go back, and the reading out loud is what helps me to figure out, do I need a tagline, do I not need a tagline? I'm also a big believer. Stephen King said in his book on writing, adverbs are not our friend. He said it, and that was very, very poignant. Use them when you have to, you know. As far as the dialogue goes, if the tagline's necessary between two people, yes. Maybe it's for pace. Maybe it's for stopping to reflect. Maybe it's something that you are trying to create a tone to show something about the personality of the character or setting the mood or whatever. But here again, if it's in the dialogue, you already got the tone in the dialogue, you don't need to say it again in the tagline. So it's a matter of, I think, I like reading it out loud. I like, because my books, being for children, being for young adults, there are going to be teachers out there in the classroom reading the book. They're going to read it out loud to their students. And there's nothing worse than hearing a teacher read it and reading it out the way you thought it should be read. So a lot of that comes back to me. The writer is my fault. Did I put something in that created a bad pace, or so that it be misinterpreted or however? So I like to read it out loud to see kind of how a teacher might read it, and then read it to myself again as a reader would read it. And that's just how I go through in the editing process to try to make it cleaner.
Now, you've gotten two writing tips here for those of you who want to write. Ears up time. In something Rick, as Rick was reading, he showed you another way to do a tagline. Blah, 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 Mr. Franklin. If Joe says Mr. Franklin, then you know who's speaking. Now, you can't do that too much because people don't really. Dialogue in books is pseudo-dialogue anyway. It's paradialogue. It's not really how people speak. But one way, if you don't want to use a tagline, is, you know, and it, you'll get a feel for it in your own writing. Okay, I've written five exchanges, and I will often throw in, so how do you think about that, Prager? So now you know it's not Mo Prager speaking. Now, I'm sure somebody's going to ask us what happens when you get three and four characters. Another thing you just learned is read aloud when you write. This is when I teach writing classes, and Rick and I will be teaching a writing class at Salem College in February. One of the things that I tell new writers is read it aloud, because different parts of your brain recognize different mistakes. And you will catch almost all of your grammatical mistakes if you read aloud to people. So those are two really important tips that, you know, this is what you paid for. The question is, dialogue serves many purposes. Do you use it just to move the plot along? Do you use it for character development? And if you do, in which ways do you do that? And I'll go back to Darren for this.
Well, I guess my viewpoint would be it's a little bit of everything. I mean, I think your dialogue, yes, is moving the story along. That's, if it's not moving the story along, why did you choose to let the character talk and you didn't say it yourself? But also, I think the characters in the dialogue and how they speak, like CJ, bless her heart, she is very country, very back, grown-up trailer park thing, very, very poor, and that's in her dialogue, but she'll use that as her strength later on in the story. I'm developing the character as well as moving the story along. But also, I think character development is going to come, yes, like you were saying, in the action of the character, what the character does, how they treat other people, how they look at the situation, the things you allow your character to do in the story, it's moving your story along, how they approach things. I think you're going to develop character not just in dialogue. You're not going to develop your plot just in dialogue. I think dialogue is a very, very powerful tool, but you, the author, have a hand in that too, depending on what you're writing, of course, third person, first person, or whatever. So I think there are a lot of things you can do. You've got to look at your overall chapter, how each chapter moves the story along, how each dialogue moves the story along, how each action does, and that's where you go, then you start trimming. If you don't need it, get rid of it, because if it's just stuff that's just fluff, what was the purpose of it? So I think it's a little bit of everything. It's a hodgepodge.
Dialogue does serve both purposes, and it can even do more than that. It can serve as a shorthand for establishing a character. Some years ago, when I was actually practicing as a psychologist, we had a child advocate in the Charlotte area who's unfortunately no longer with us. He passed away about 6-7 months ago. But he was very famous for, in the middle of a meeting, he would lean back in his chair and he would hook his thumbs under his belt and he would say, "Well, I'm just an old country boy, but it seems to me," well, if he ever said that and he was talking to you, you were already in such deep trouble that, I mean, you were facing a subpoena within the next 6 weeks. Because when he said that, what he was basically saying was, you need to change the way you're doing things right now, or we're going to be talking about this in front of a judge. And that whole bit, the I'm just an old country boy turned into a character shorthand for him, and he actually gave me permission to use it, and I have used it in a book that I recently did. So you can actually establish a character just by the way a person says something that's not actually part of a sequential conversation. It's just a tagline or a shorthand for this is the way things are.
And just briefly, I think what happens is you will find your way. Now, when you notice, when I read my dialogue, there was I stopped at some point and did a brief description of what was going on, and how Mo was being viewed by the golfers with suspicion, and how they were scowling at him like he was one rung up the evolutionary ladder from Silverfish. Yes, I love that line. I always know I'm doing something right when I either entertain myself, I make myself laugh or cry when I'm writing. I know I'm doing something right. But you'll find your way. It's only a matter of, like, we don't have any secrets. There are tips, but there are no secrets to writing. And usually if you don't do something well, it just means you have to write more. You know, the problem about writing, I think, is that people don't realize is it takes a lot of writing to get good at something. You know, I play basketball. I'm 50 years old. I play basketball every day. I still play with people better than me because I won't get better if I don't play with people better than me. And so I think you should aspire very high to a high standard when you write, and don't be satisfied so quickly with your writing, because it's took all the three of us a long time to get where we are. Because I walked here and didn't fly. No, it took all of us. It is a really odd process. If you're struggling with something, it just means you have to do more of it and struggle more with it. The question is given a long passage of dialogue, would you rather use a tagline, like a he said, she said, or do indicate through description of action who's speaking? And I'll give the quick, I think there's a quick answer to that. You will have a feel for that. I mean, there's no rule about that. Do it both ways and see which works better, and then edit the other one out. Is the rule, don't use contractions, a viable rule? I think I can answer again for the three of us. Cover your ears, people who don't like cursing. It's utter nonsense. Well, no one, I don't even think Shakespeare followed that rule. Can you ever have too much dialogue?
If you're talking about nothing. If you're talking about nothing, I've read pieces of dialogue where somebody walks into the room and you've got a page and a half of chit chat before they get down to what the real issue is. Hi, Bob. How are you doing today? I'm doing just great, Susie. Did you catch that Mets game last night? Oh, yeah, that was a real corker, wasn't it? Okay, they go on like that, and you're trying to establish a camaraderie, a repartee with them, but it's just dead dialogue, and it's not advancing the story at all. And you finally just say, this is the area when I'm actually editing stuff, where I'll write over in the margin, M-E-G-O. And then the person will say, what does M-E-G-O mean? And I say, my eyes glazed over.
Well, like Mr. Coleman said, you'll get a feel for it. If you're reading it back out loud, you'll realize this belongs, this doesn't belong, and what they're saying is right. If it's useless, get rid of it. You're boring the reader. And I say that I try that because I had never written a novel in first person. And my seventh graders, I had a group that had a hard time getting to turn their homework in, and I said, okay, if you'll write, I'll write. I'll bring you my rough drafts. You take me the cleaners now, okay? And so they said, okay, we'll write in first person. They knew that was something my weakness. And I did it. I did it, and I loved it. And that might be where you want to go, is take a chapter of whatever you're working on and redo it in first person and see if it becomes an opening experience for you. That then all of a sudden you've got this beautiful dialogue, but from the viewpoint of that one character and then the rest of it comes into play, that might work really well. Just give us an exercise. Try it.
And if you can dispense with dialogue by saying they exchange pleasantries instead of a page of dialogue, then that dialogue that you had doesn't belong in the book. If all the information that's being I mean, dialogue is a vehicle, as was brought up before. It's not a bad way to move your story along, but it's certainly not the only. And if it's the only way to move your story along, it will. The reader will eventually just MEGO. Yeah, you really. If you can use one sentence to get rid of a page of dialogue by saying, you know, Rudy exchanged pleasantries instead of, you know, the Mets game was great yesterday, and that all, then use the one line, okay?
The question is, he heard a lot of country accent in this particular character that I read, and he's heard that you shouldn't write things that way. Well, that's my character. I know that child. If I write her differently and I take away the reckons and the gettins, she's no longer that character. I want her to jump off the page at you. I want you to see this kid in little overalls and piggytails and hear that mouth, and she's got quite a mouth. And if I change her dialogue, she's no longer CJ. Yes, throughout. And that's been difficult, let me tell you. Spellcheck hates that stuff. You know, they do.
I shut spellcheck off.
I do. I shut spellcheck off. I had to with this novel especially because it just stopped my flow. Other thing is we've not talked about is you need to be in a critique group. Like, I missed my critique group, and Marianne's over there saying he missed it Wednesday night. I did. But you need to be in a critique group. Critique group is a great place to take and read your writing to have others to listen and give you ideas and things like that. But this whole rule about, meaning about this whole rule about don't do that, it's the character. You know, sometimes rules are made to be broken, and they're made by people sometimes that don't write, you know, unfortunately. I love my character. I wouldn't change it for blood or money. And if it doesn't get published, fine. I don't care. She's my character. She's my book. It's my enjoyment. You know, that's what I do it for, my enjoyment to begin with. So that's who she is, and I'm not going to change that.
It's funny that you should bring that up, because just as we were in the parking lot pulling in here, we were having a discussion of the rules. And when is it okay for an author not to pay attention to the rules, and who has the right to set the rules? And I think we established sort of the rule, don't you? And I'll let Rick tell you what the rule is about the rules and paying attention to the rules.
The rules, well, I think we were talking about in context of Elmore Leonard's Rules for Writing, which end with the final rule, which is, please feel free to ignore these rules if it fits. The problem is that, you know, this is Elmore Leonard saying that. If you're Elmore Leonard, you can afford to ignore the rules. But the rules are there for a reason. You have to learn how to walk before you can run. So you can afford to ignore the rules if you've developed that level of expertise that you know that by ignoring these rules for writing, that you can step outside of them and do it in a fair way that doesn't cheat the reader, that doesn't ruin the piece or violate things like the character, or violate that imaginary fourth wall, or whatever it is that you're trying to maintain in the story. And that takes a lot of finesse and a lot of experience to know when you're stepping over that line. You step over the line, you spoil the story.
I just like to add to that is one of the things that new writers worry about a lot is getting published, as well they should. It's the hard. We were having a discussion in the hotel bar last night about this very issue. The thing is, when you sit down to write, and I know this is a bit of a digression from dialogue per se, but when you sit down to write, one of the things you should know when you sit down to write is no one may ever read this other than you. Writing, you, believe it or not, there, you have three fearless people sitting up here in front of you, because there is no guarantee that anything we write is going to get published. So one of the things that new writers often cling to are the rules, because they think if I follow the rules, I'll get published. Well, that ain't how it works. You have to be good at it. It's not building a model. You have to have talent to do it, and courage, maybe more courage than talent. So don't cling to the rules. Even some of the stuff we've said is people who've published many books. You know, the bottom line is, when you sit down and write, you may never get published. But that takes a lot of courage, and if you do it, you deserve a lot of credit. So don't cling to the rules so much. Don't cling to everything we say, because we were lucky. We have some talent, and we were lucky. And that's how it works. That is a rule. One last thing. If something is worthy of publication, someone will publish it. So, any other questions? How do you deal with non sequiturs in your dialogue, and is it a good technique to use for character development?
Here again, I think it depends on the character. You know, what are you trying to accomplish? If it's like the example you just said, if that builds your character, if that paints the scene, and the reader learns something about that character, I would say yes, that'd be great. You know, but if it doesn't and it confuses the reader, then you haven't accomplished what your goal was. Okay.
Yeah, what he said.
What they said. You'll develop a feel for it. You'll know if it's right or not over the course of time. One of the first rules that I ever heard was in a master class I did with Edward Albee about 30 years ago. And what he said was, at least for him, a rule was, don't ever put a word down on paper until it can write itself. You rehearse it, you work it out in your head, you think about it, and then you put it down on the paper. Well, that's not necessarily the way that I work. It's not necessarily the way that Reader Darren works, but it worked for him. And you will discover the way that the rules work for you, what rules work and which ones that you can conveniently or at least successfully ignore along the way. Now, for me, I do rehearse dialogue a lot. I'm very famous for doing it in the shower. My wife will come in, and there'll be a fog like this, a foot and a half down from the ceiling, and the wallpaper's peeling off the wall, and she'll say, oh, you're writing, I'll leave. So I'll rehearse dialogue when I'm cutting the grass or when I'm driving home from work. I've got about a 45-minute, one-hour drive home from work. I'll rehearse a little dialogue then, and then I'll put it down on paper. Or sometimes I'll just get one little line, and I'll say, I've got a ride with this, and I'll just hop right on the computer. It just depends on how it strikes me and how I feel like working on that given day. So the rules can be bent for yourself on any given day.
And by the way, Rick's wife sells those photos from the shower on the internet. So, any other questions? When you're doing dialogue and doing dialect within dialogue, you know, what are the danger areas? And I think I'm going to take. I'll answer this one. It is very you tread on very dangerous water. As when you attack, not attack meaning set upon, but when you attack in terms of your writing, minorities, especially sensitive issues. And I have been warned similarly. I have a detective novel I was going to do a proposal for set in the backdrop of the Civil War. Now, for many reasons, I was warned this was a dangerous thing to do. For one thing, there are all sorts of buffs in the world. There are aircraft buffs and police buffs, but there are no buffs like Civil War buffs. You know, that there are just, you know, if you get one thing wrong, like the shape of a button on the Fighting 69th from New York, if you say, you know, get a name wrong, you will get flooded with emails. So that's dangerous. And the second thing is you tread on very dangerous waters when you do slave voices. And I'm not saying you shouldn't do it. I think people get rightly nervous for you. Yeah, it's a very difficult challenge. It really is a very difficult challenge. And I don't have an answer for that. I mean, I still want to write this book, and I still think you should write your book. But you open yourself up to train loads of criticism if you don't do it exactly right. So I'm sorry I can't give you a better answer, but I certainly sympathize with you. Is it more important to use timing and setting to circumvent getting the dialect exactly right? My answer to that would be it depends on the author. I mean, I don't think that's true. I think it helps, but I don't think it's true. I don't think you can avoid slave talk in the Civil War. If you're going to have a character who's a slave, he or she needs to speak like a slave. But there's a rule, again, that's my rule. That's not, the rule.
One of the things you can do is, I understand what you're talking about with the dropping the G's and the apostrophes and all that. That can become incredibly tedious to read. And so you can get by with it maybe once in a while just to kind of get the feel in there. But one thing you can also use is colloquialisms. I don't know how things are done here in the Nashville area. Where I live, we have a little saying called, bless your heart. And bless your heart isn't necessarily, you're not necessarily saying a very nice thing to that person. It could be, oh, you poor thing. Or it could be, is it really possible that you are that incredibly freaking stupid? Okay? there's lots of things you can say just by saying, well, bless your heart. and you can write that into that and get the feel for the region that you're writing without having to resort to all of these literary using the IN apostrophe and trying to do with Reed is from Brooklyn, D's Dem Do's stuff. It's not necessary if you can get the feel from the way that people talk in terms of the words they use and the terms they use. You don't have to use the other shorthand.
I totally agree. It's like in this book, CJ ends up at her great aunt Vesta's in Alabama, very small rural community, and Vesta has an African-American maid. And instead of creating a whole other dialect for her, I didn't do that because she's grown up, she's lived with Aunt Vesta, and she was 14 years old. So she has a much more proper dialect that I used her actions and used the things she did and things like, well, just bless her heart, because we do that in the South, too, big time. And so I did things like that inside the character and in her dialogue and her actions that you still have this picture of her character and where she fits into the story and how she fits into her class without going crazy on some dialect or things like that. I let CJ's aints and stuff like that, I let that carry through the novel pretty well. I think it's from her point of view. So, but I've treaded very carefully with Great Aunt Vesta's maid.
The question is, as opposed to using dialect and dialogue, people often, which it occurs frequently now, different ways to connote dialogue without quotation marks. And I'd say I don't think it's a trend, but it does rear its head every now and then. I find it distracting. Unless you establish the let me see if I can remember. There was a movie called The Commitments about a bunch of poor Dublin kids who start a R&B band. I was about 10 years old. And I read the book from which that movie was made, and in it there are no quotation marks. But he established early on there just aren't going to be quotation marks, and so you get used to it. This is one of my prejudices. I prefer quotation marks. I don't want to confuse the reader. I mean, one of the rules you're told when you're writing is you never want to confuse the reader or bore the reader. You don't. A death sentence for a book is someone gets to page 20 and they go, they're confused and they have to look back. Once the pages start going like when you read Hebrew in the opposite direction, you're in big trouble. So I find anything that's distracting I find that stuff distracting, but that's just me. And I really don't approve of when people do block letters for emphasis. That's what italics are for, and there are ways to do things that people just get lazy about. I don't think doing something non-traditional is good just because it's non-traditional.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think I wouldn't do it. I mean, just because I don't feel comfortable as a writer doing it. Now, down the road, 10 years from now, I may go, I'm going to try that, but I'd have a real hard time doing that, because that's the main thing. If I confuse my reader, and my readers are young, you know, they are anywhere from second grade up through high school. If I confuse a second grader and they stop reading my book, well, I've defeated my whole purpose. I've lost my audience. So look at your audience. Who's reading your book? If they can handle it and you feel comfortable and you're really good at it, go for it. But if you're not, I'd say don't.
Yeah, and just as a quick tip, anything when you send a manuscript off to an agent, because you're going to have to get an agent before you get a publisher. It's easier, in fact, to get a publisher than it is to get an agent. Anything you do which will make the agent put your manuscript down, don't do. That is a rule. Because if you wanted it, you know, because my agent's office in Manhattan is his stacks and stacks of unsolicited manuscripts. Believe me, if you do one thing which is going to make him put your manuscript down, you know, publish a few books, then go non-traditional. But don't do stuff that'll make an agent or a publisher put your manuscript down.
I don't think there's any place in the United States, and perhaps, I don't know, I'm not that well-traveled in the entire world, where red light means go. red light means stop, green light means go, yellow light means go very, very fast. These are conventions. These are things that we've incorporated into our understanding, because it helps things flow more smoothly. Quotation marks help things flow more smoothly. The use of capitalization helps things flow more smoothly. For goodness sake, punctuation. Please learn to punctuate. And learn where the comma goes. And because it helps things to flow more smoothly. You don't want to have what we refer to as literary speed bumps in the middle of your book. There's a scene in Jaws that I absolutely love. Because every time I see it, it stops me right there. It's a scene where I think it's the second shark attack, and Brody is sitting on the beach, and as the shark attacks, the camera zooms into Brody, but as it zooms into Brody, the background zooms back. And when I first saw that, I spent the next 10 minutes thinking, how'd they do that? Okay, what kind of lens do they use? How do they figure that out? And I missed the next 10 minutes of the movie because I'm trying to figure out how they did this wonderful shot. Well, you may do some very wonderfully artistic things in your book, but if they stop the reader in his tracks, you have got to cut that out.
Okay, and any other questions?
I'm not doing this to you.
Right.
The question is, what are our favorite things that we like about our own dialogue? Mine is when it evokes emotion, whether it makes the reader laugh or makes them cry. Just pick out two emotions. But, you know, I'm like grief. When I make myself laugh out loud, that's really kind of fun. You know, or if I write something, I'm doing this play right now, for example, and of course it's all dialogue. And there are some lines in there that just, I guess by accident, or hopefully I'm just getting better at this, I watch my actors get tears in their eyes. So that's when it's cool. That's when you think, wow, I can't believe I did that. You know, and that's an exciting part of writing, when you evoke emotion in people when they read your stuff.
I enjoy the unexpected when I use dialogue to do the unexpected. And I just wrote a scene like this yesterday. I have my computer in my room here, and I'm almost at the end of the book that follows this book up. And Mo, who's a private detective, who used to be just a uniformed cop on the NYPD, he thinks he's figured out what's going on, and he's having a meeting with an ex-mafia capo who's dying of lung cancer, which, you know, there's another trick about, you know, there should be no two-dimensional characters in your books. You know, people, no money's all good, nobody's all bad. So, of course, he's a mafia capo, he's a bad guy, but he's dying of lung cancer, and if you've ever seen, as my mom did, die of lung cancer, you wouldn't wish that on anybody. So that's a trick about, you know, have sympathy for bad people. In any case, Mo goes to him because he wants to be told that, see, I figured this out. And he and what happens is, in the course of their dialogue, Mo realizes he got it all wrong. So when the characters fool the writer – Right. Now you're reading this along, and that's why I don't do an outline, because I like being surprised by my own. And I, you know what? This works better if I do this. And that only happens when I'm writing dialogue. So when I drop a bomb on the characters and on myself and on the potential readers, that's my favorite part of dialogue.
I think it changes over the course of the time that you write. When you start out, you enjoy different things. Right now, I'm really excited about something that I'm doing that's kind of technical. And my two favorite writing books, the two books that have taught me more about writing, are, interestingly enough, Strunk and White, and The Rhetoric of Film. I learned more by reading a book called The Rhetoric of Film about writing than I have reading all these books about writing. And because one of the things about film is you can compress time, you can expand time, you can jump cut, you can do all kinds of things. And I thought, well, you can do that in writing too. Why not? And so I've gotten into a little practice now that I'm doing, and I'm trying it out in new scenes with dialogue where I don't necessarily resolve a scene when it's over. I may end it before the scene is actually resolved, before there's a resolution, before there's a closure in that scene, and move on to the next scene. As long as the main idea is there, I don't feel it necessary to have two people get closure in a scene before I move on to the next part of the story. And that's a film technique that I've kind of adapted into dialogue. And the more I work with that, the more excited I am about it.
Well, I've been given the sign. So I would like to thank you, first of all, for coming, because, you know, without you, it doesn't matter what we do. So thank you very much. And I'd like to thank my fellow panelists, and please buy our books. Thank you.